Well, you know what, Bass Pro? I've breed fish since I was 9 years old. You can kiss my expletive.
All of a sudden, this like 70 or 80 year old lady comes around the corner with her fist cocked back all the way to Japan.
Fresh ambergris is described as having a marine fecal odor.
If you gotta check your friggin' line right away, I know we're gonna be doing some softcore stuff.
Good morning, degenerate anglers, and welcome to Bent, the fishing podcast that just got a couple of stripers we'll be bringing in for dinner. Won't be long, and otherwise haven't seen anything yet. I'm Joe Cermelli.
Ah,
you like that?
Multi, and that was a solid, yes. Solidly obscure as well. Jaws reference there. Well done, my friend.
Yeah, man.
I don't know where you're going with it, but it was great. I liked it.
Good. Well, it's actually one of my favorite lines in the whole movie, and it slips past many radars. It's like a quiet sleeper.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not taking a shark fishing. I'm actually using that to take a striper fishing today.
Stripers.
Yes.
See, striper. You already took us mahi fishing in Jersey this week.
I did.
Settle down there, guy. Bring it down a notch. I hope everyone listening has already watched episode one of B-Side Fishing on Meteor's YouTube channel. If not, go watch it. It's amazing. You're missing out.
Yeah, but of course, you guys watch. Of course they did, man.
I hope so.
Of course they watched it. These are my people. Seriously, though, huge thanks to everyone who did tune in to B-Side Fishing this week. And if you didn't, perchance, just go find it as soon as you're done listening to Bent. Okay, I appreciate it. Mm-hmm. And I got to say, it feels good to be back in front of a camera while holding a fishing rod. And also, editing video again, I get to cut B-side, which is super fun, and I'm proud of it, and I love doing that.
No, so. You should be. It's very, very well done, and
it's taken
a little longer than we wanted to get you bringing another show out, but it's here. Yeah. Everyone can just settle down and go
watch
it. Stop
asking, okay? It happened. I promised it would.
And I got to say, striper fishing seems like a fitting theme for this week, considering the B-side's all about like scenes.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about like fishing scenes and fishing cultures more than the specific fish. And I'm fascinated by the striper scene. I don't know as much about it firsthand as I would like, partially because I'm ashamed to admit this, I've never caught one, but I'm interested. Like it has my attention.
No, I know you haven't caught one, but you know, that's okay. And hopefully I'll be the one to change that lack of stripers for you at some point. We'll striper
I hope
fish
so.
Together.
I hope so.
But I think one of the reasons we get along so well is that we both have a deep appreciation of sort of niche fishing scenes and cultures, even if we don't have much experience within them, right?
Like, yeah, oh yeah, yeah.
I have literally fished for West Coast steelhead one time in my life for about 3 hours, and I caught nothing. But I'm still very intrigued by the West Coast steel scene and the people in it, you know, very, very much. So what we're doing this week, which we haven't really done before, is going all in on an entire scene. And it's not about the fish. It's about a fishing culture. And the striper scene is very near and dear to me because that's one I do happen to be a part of.
Well, yeah. I mean, didn't you like write a book about it or something? I mean, it seems like
sort of.
It seems like something you might have some familiarity with.
Sort of. I wrote The Complete Guide to Surf Casting, and I joke that I did that when I was 12. Like, it feels that long ago now. Like, it was so many years ago. However, I'll go on record and say that what the publisher of that book wanted was a 101-style book. So it looks at surf casting in a very broad view and touches on a lot more than stripers. But I lay no claim now, nor have I ever laid claim to being some kind of striper surf sharpie or like the hardest of the hardcore, because I'm not. But I surf fished my ass off for many years and you know, did rub elbows with a bunch of guys that I consider the greats, one of which basically prompted the entire theme of the show.
That's true. Just so you guys get a window into how this all works, like, we have a conversation, and then we're like, hey, we should make a show around that. And
yes,
in this particular case, I got to sit in on that conversation, and I kind of felt like the geeky science kid showing up for basketball practice, but I learned a lot. Like, I wasn't on the inner circle there. But I was fascinated in everything I heard.
I'm glad you were there. It was fun.
Yeah. And we're gonna share an abridged version of that discussion in our Smooth Moves segment, where we let guides and captains talk about dumb or otherwise hilarious things that their clients have done. And this one, it's a little longer than normal, but so was last week's. So I mean, we're playing around with these. We're trying to give these stories a little more room to breathe and see how that works and let us know what you think. I should also preface this by saying, I personally know what it takes to like herd and wrangle and babysit anglers when you're just standing in a river. And I cannot imagine having to guide people, like especially rookies, in the places and situations that Bill Wetzel goes.
Why did you do that? Why? Why did you do that, Terry? Oh my God.
So joining us today on Smooth Moves, somewhat of a legend in my area, Bill Wetzel is here with us. And Bill, you are like the dude in the Northeast surf scene, are you not? Like kind of like the Godfather. Would you call yourself the Godfather?
No, I'm just a fisherman. Okay. I've been doing it a long time, you know, just a fisherman like anybody else. You know, Montauk is my home.
Like anybody else, I just know more than everybody else.
Where I like to fish.
Exactly. But I mean, be that as it may, you're the guy behind Surf Rats Ball. I mean, you know, everybody who surf fishes from Massachusetts to Jersey knows who you are. And why I'm so excited to have you on is because we've had so many different kinds of guides, offshore, fly guides, on Smooth Moves. But I mean, people pay you to take them surf fishing and like not on a quiet beach somewhere. Like you are the guy who will take people to famed spots like the Montauk Rocks, big league surf fishing where you're swimming out to rocks in the dark, crashing surf, dangerous situations. So I figure you had to have seen some shit in doing that for how long has it been? 22 years, you told me?
Something like that, 22 years. And you believe people freaking pay me for this?
I'm
yelling at them. I'm screaming at them. Get off the rock. Get on the rock. And they freaking pay me to be yelled at.
Yeah. Well, and I have to ask because I've played this game. I grew up around here. Like, you know, how do you vet somebody who comes to you and is looking to be guided, like knowing what they're going to get into? Is there like sort of a process for like, yeah, this guy can probably hang. This guy I don't want anything to do with. What do you do?
Well, you know, the phone rings, like if you get somebody's booking, the phone rings, and the first thing I ask them, how long you've been fishing? And then I'm like, how's your agility? How old are you? You know, all those questions. And they're like, oh, you know, I'm like, and then if you want to book a trophy trip, my standard question is, can you stand on a rock about 150 yards out into the water in the middle of the night with a 30-knot wind coming in your face, 6 to 8 foot sets pounding on you? And if your answer is no, then you can't do a trophy trip, but you can do a regular trip, you know. So, you know, and then I'll ask, you know, the equipment questions are big. You know, what kind of equipment do you have? What kind of line do you have? I don't know. Let me go check my line. If you got to check your friggin' line right away, I know that, you know, we're going to be doing some soft core stuff. You know what I mean? We're not going to be out on the friggin' rocks most likely. I will push your ass hard. If I feel that you're capable, I will push your ass. Even okay. At my age, I will still push your ass, even if you're 22 years old.
This sounds more like a personal training session than a fishing trip. That's like that's what I'm hearing.
Oh,
like,
speaking of this, I got a quick story if you want to hear it.
That's what you're here for, man. No, tell us a story.
So I just thought it just popped in my mind. So I used to take this guy out. He was from France all the time. He's a good guy. Loved him. He booked me several times. This is many, many years ago. I was 43 at the time. Now I'm 56. So one night we had a nor'easter roll in, and it was blowing like, I don't know, like 45 knots. You know, piss and rain, new moon. It's like 1 o'clock in the morning, and we're getting ready. And I don't know if you're familiar with the south side of Montauk.
I've fished it, yeah.
Yeah, so we're going into the south side of not Montauk with like a 45-knot northeast winds, huge water. The water's like, you know, I don't know, like 6 to 7 feet, you know. And we're getting ready, and he goes, hey, Bill, how old are you? I go, 43. 43? That's old. I can't believe you're like an old man. He was like in his 20s. I'm like, oh, yeah, motherfucker. I was like, I'm going to show you how old I am tonight. I didn't say that, but in my head, I just like snapped, man. I freaking snapped. And I took him out. And, you know, I said to myself, I'm going to be aggressive as I possibly can. I'm going to do exactly what I would do personally. So we start walking out. I can tell he's behind me. He's like, you sure this is all right, Bill? Now you got to realize it's in the middle of the night. It's a new moon. So on top of the rain, it's pissing rain, on top of the big northeast winds and the big water, it's completely black because it's the new moon on top of it all, you know. So he can't see anything. And he's going, Bill, you sure about this? I'm like, yeah, get your ass out here. We're going. So, and we get halfway out. We're about 50, 60 yards out, and there's peanut bunker everywhere, man. Peanut bunker getting washed off the reef into the deeper water. And I'm just like bugging, and that just like pushed me even harder. So I'm like, so I just kept going and going and going. I see him behind me, and this is the same damn spot on a nor'easter. I almost lost a customer. So, so we were out there, and we're not getting shit. And I'm like screaming, you know, through the roar and everything. I can't believe we're not catching fish. I just can't believe it. This is like, I don't know, like mid October, and we were out there in the surf, I guess, for an hour and a half or so. You know, we start walking back. I'm like, all right, next spot. We're going to go on the south side again. We're going to walk about a mile in. He's like, hour and a half, dude. He's like, I'm done, man. I'm exhausted. I'm like, oh, yeah, motherfucker. I dropped him off and I went fishing. You know? I don't know. You know, I don't know if he booked me after that night again. You know, I mean, he always booked me. He was good. I mean, we were booking like, I don't know, 7 or 8 trips a year with him. I think he'd moved though. I think he went to France or something. Really nice guy.
Did you catch anything when you went back out by yourself?
No, I walked about a mile and a half. I went way back in. And I'm like, oh man, it's the perfect conditions. You know, I went to a really risky spot, especially in that, and with my waders in a wetsuit, and didn't catch anything that whole night. Man, there's bait everywhere, too. I still, you know, those kind of nights haunt you, man.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I thought absolutely. That was going to go another way. I got to admit, I thought it was going to be like you dropped him off and then you went out and just wailed on him.
Well,
no, I've done that, too.
Does that happen often, even if it's not bad blood in the beginning? Like, do you just take guys out frequently at night and who are just like, I can't do this? I mean, does it happen a fair amount?
Oh, yeah. So, like, I'll take a guy out and we'll get out on the rocks. And I first thing I tell him, especially if I know, you know, they might not be capable and it's their first time. I mean, you got to realize it's like 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning. And I've already, usually with a guy like that, I've already went through the steps and went through the easy stuff. And now it's time to get out on the rocks, to, you know. And I'll say, you know, if you get out there and you can't do it, you know, just let me know. We can go somewhere else. I always tell them, if you're uncomfortable, and they'll say, Bill, I'm uncomfortable. So I'm just like, let a couple waves hit you, you know. And if they fall down, it's a good thing. If they like get knocked off their rock and fall down, as long as they don't get hurt, it's a good thing, because now you're wet and you know what it feels like. I mean, that's part of Montauk. You're gonna get friggin' knocked down, and once in a while you're gonna get hurt. Not often, hopefully.
We've talked about wetsuiting and rock hopping on this show, and this is a very foreign world to Miles. So like, now that you're hearing this, like, are you like, do you still want to do this? You've wanted to do this.
I'm in. This sounds like it's exactly up my alley. I'm all about it, man. I've almost killed myself over way smaller fish than that. So
it's the best, well, man. Bolts are for sissies, brother.
Well, Bill, hopefully, I don't know, you'll get some calls from this show from Iowa and Ohio, and they'll be racing out for you to yell at them.
Oh, that'd be great.
I think we have a lot of masochists that listen to the show. Would be my guess.
Really,
so I think
they're perfect. I don't really yell at them. I'm yelling. You know, it's always windy. There's always surf. I'm just yelling.
So here's another one. Here's another question for you, man. Like, you know, in a guide game, so often, you know, it's the guide's job to untangle your knots and tie on your shit and this, that, and the other thing. But when you're putting a guy on a rock here and you're not and you're not like right next to the dude, how does that work? Like, what if dude fires one off and it's like, screw?
No, man. I mean, you know, the older I get, the harder it gets. You know, I mean, sometimes I'm taking out two guys and I have one guy on this rock and one guy on that rock. And I'm in this, I call it guide rock all the time because I get the shittiest rock. It's, you know, it's like that big and I got both feet on it and I'm like in my 50s, you know. And, you know, the one guy have his freaking, he's all tangled up or he's snagged on something. And so then I have to get down off my rock in the surf, you know, way out in big water or light water, whatever it is, and go untangle that guy. And then meanwhile, I got the guy on my right hand. Oh, Bill, I got on a fish. Or, oh, my God, I got a knot. Now I got two guys, and I'm going back and forth in the surf between the two guys. Now, I know I look like I'm a fat guy and couldn't do that, but I trust me, when I'm in the surf, I'm a different person.
Man, I hope you guys found that as entertaining as we did. And while we don't normally plug websites on this show, if you're one of those masochists and you want the real Montauk surf experience, surfratsball.com. That's where you'll find Bill. And not just to book him, because the guy is also just a wealth of surf casting info. And let me stress, what you are booking here is truly an experience. Right, I know. Like we say that about a lot of book your experience.
It's an experience.
It's an experience. Strong chance you will catch some bass with Bill, one way or the other. But like you book that for the whole show, not just the fish. You know what I mean?
I mean, it seems like you book it to test yourself
a little bit.
Can I hang with this guy? I want to know. It seems like my kind of jam, to be honest.
And I can see you doing this. Yeah.
Like part of the reason I say that is I imagine that whole late night rock hopping is a pretty solitary game. Like it's very different from packing a boat with buddies or setting up next to each other in a run. And I do like the social aspect of fishing, but to me, there's something about that solitary, really driven type of fishing that attracts me.
Yes. And you're absolutely right, which is what makes Bill's scene, you know, his gig kind of unique, because really it's not a social thing. You know, on the beach in the middle of the day with the truck out there and your buddies, that's one thing.
Yeah.
But the drill down, kick out to a rock, stand on a rock, it's not a social thing at all. And you might show up with a buddy, but you might not see him again until you're both back at the truck hours later. You know, like hardcore surf fishing in Montauk and Block Island, it's a very me against nature kind of deal. But Bill has somehow made it work as a guide gig. And like for a long time, like he's been doing this a long time.
Yeah.
Though I don't imagine he's getting like a lot of corporate bookings, you know what I mean? Like where the entire IT staff shows up to fish with Bill, you know? I don't think he can do that.
Dude, the entire IT staff might show up, but only half of them would still be around. Like when you shuffle on into the bar at the end of it, like you might have some attrition there.
That's Darwinism, isn't it? Survival of the fittest, you know? You need to scale down your IT department a little bit, you know what I mean? Book with Bill. But speaking of bars, we are going to stay in Montauk for just a little bit longer, and we're going to scope out where many of the stripermen in what is arguably the fishiest town in the Northeast go for suds. Also, keeping up with storytelling here, this week's That's My Bar nomination and background is being brought to us by none other than Bent correspondent Captain Zach Hammer Miller. We're just going to kind of stay out of this one and just let him throw down, because this joint holds a special place in his heart.
Best goddamn bartender from Timbuktu to Portland, Maine. Portland, Oregon, for that matter.
This is Captain Zach the Hammer Miller of Throwdown Fishing Charters, and I am here to tell you, if you were ever fortunate enough to roll through Montauk, a.k.a. the surf fishing capital of the world, that you have to stop at one of the best bars I've ever been to in my life, called Liar Saloon. It has everything you want in a little crappy dive bar at the end of the earth. It has a jukebox you could still play Pantera on, a foosball table that sometimes eats your coins, and some rickety bar stools and some very, very scary bartenders. For instance, the first time I was going to Liars, it was about 2 a.m. and we were stumbling up from our motel just down the street, and we heard it was the only place that was open in town. And as we made our way through this giant dirt parking lot, there was a bunch of people on this wooden ramp that leads up to the bar. And they were outside smoking and having a drink and just hanging out. And when we made it halfway up the ramp, all of a sudden, this dude comes flying out of the door, hits the railing, and falls down. And I'm like, holy shit, what is going on here? So the dude gets up, and all of a sudden, this like 70 or 80-year-old lady comes around the corner with her fist cocked back all the way to Japan, saying, I'll give you another one if you come back here again. The kid keeps talking his shit, and the lady punched him square in the friggin' face again. It was absolutely unbelievable. And from then on, every time I'm up there, they could have all my money. They could have all my time. They could have all my lies. Their foosball table could eat all my coins, and their jukebox could take all my tokens for Pantera. What else do you want in a place that looks like it's better situated with Mark Wahlberg sitting at a bar in the perfect storm than Liar's Saloon?
I feel like that was if B. Arthur had a role in Roadhouse, that's how it would have gone down.
Yeah, man.
I want to drink there. I you can't make that kind of stuff up. I want to go. I want to drink there, and I want to go with Zach.
Yeah, you should. I mean, he only drinks Bush lattes, so I don't know if they serve that. But that's yeah. But you're right. It's like Roadhouse meets Golden Girls. And of course, I've been there. And it's a super cool spot for sure. Very iconic and very different from the wine bars and like tapas restaurants in the nearby Hamptons. Like it's a cool spot. I'll just assume there's some level of exaggeration in that story because it went down just that way. Probably. But it's based mostly on facts. So anyway, speaking of facts, we're about to throw some at you in this week's much anticipated fish news.
Fish news!
That escalated quickly.
Hey, so you know, we already told you how pumped we are about B-side fishing having finally dropped this week. Woo-hoo. But listen up. If you were a fan of episode one, and I hope you were, and you don't, as in do not feel like waiting for the other episodes to roll out over the course of the next month, we can actually give you a secret code to watch them all right now. So grab a pencil and a post-it note. The code is up, up, down, down, left, right, B-A, start. Of course, I'm kidding. That's just the code to get an instant 30 lives in Contra on Nintendo. But you already knew that. Yes. I assume you knew that, too.
Of course I did, except you forgot the select button in that sequence.
I did. Shit.
It's yeah, select did, start. Right. So even if that was the code, it wouldn't have worked. It wouldn't have worked nothing at all. But we actually do have a secret code that absolutely will work. Meat Eater just launched a newsletter called Fishing Weekly with Joe Cermelli and crew. I guess I'm in the crew. And if you signed up for it, if you guys sign up for it, we will send you a link to watch every single season one episode of B-Side Fishing right this minute, right now. You get them all.
Yep. Yep. You are the main guy in the crew, and that is all correct. And look, not only will signing up for our newsletter keep you plugged into all the cool new fishing shit we're doing at Meat Eater, but you can consider this like a friendly email directly from me, your buddy, Joe C. I'm going to say dumb shit and write dumb shit that will entice you to look at all the cool stuff that we're doing. There might even be like a degenerate corner of sorts where I recommend some tunage, some jams, maybe tell you what I think you should be listening to if you want us to think you're cooler than we already think you are. So that's another thing that's going to be there.
There'll be music. Joe's also going to be pointing out all sorts of dumb, weird, non-fishing related shit he finds on the internet, which I get on a regular basis. So now it's not just me.
I'm always like, did you watch that? And you're like, no, I haven't yet. I'm very busy.
I haven't seen that. So there'll be the weird Joe shit. Plus, you know, we're just going to use this as a space to keep you guys up to date on all the fishing content we're making, from new shows to episodes of the podcast to featured articles. All the good stuff, right? And all these gems are going to be exclusive to Fishing Weekly. It's like the newsletter for the degenerate club that we're all in. And if you don't sign up, you'll be stuck listening to Yellow Card with Phil behind the comic book store. So I'm sure anymore there's probably a newsletter for that crowd too.
Yeah. Phil, was that more than you bargained for? Are you going down swinging on that? Phil will get that.
I'm not sorry, Phil. I got one more bit of housekeeping before we hit news. I particularly got a lot of feedback about the debate that Joe and I did over birding and if it's lame or not. And a surprising number of you wrote in support of birding and to criticize my lackluster ability to argue in favor of its merits. Apparently, I let a lot of people down there. I'm just going to quote from one of my personal favorite emails that we got. It came from listener Katie Kilgus, and it was simply titled, "Go Birding, Assholes."
Yeah, this is a good one. This is a good one.
Katie made some solid points, one of which being that I'm a dumbass because no one carries bird books anymore. They have apps for that. Because, of course, they do. She recommended the Merlin Bird ID, which connects to eBird, which is an international online database. Katie went on to say, quote, "eBird is used by scientists all over the world to track migrants yearly from citizen scientists. One could argue eBird is one of the greatest uses of citizen scientists out there. Even kids can use it. Get your head out of the water and look up just once in a while. It's lame, but so are people." And can I get an amen for that one, for Katie on that one?
Amen. It was good. It was good. I just want to point out that she ended with "love the podcast." Like, it wasn't a total dig. It's like, you guys are kind of being schmucks right now. I mean, I think, like, I like what you're doing, but like, that was yeah. So no, I very much appreciated that. Is that all your housekeeping? Is that
that's all I got?
That's all it. You got? Okay. So we can move on to our news database, see what we do there. And then, as always, remember, this is a competition. Miles and I do not know which stories the other guy is bringing to the table when we are done. Phil, our engineer, will declare one of us a winner. You've already taken a shot at Phil today, but then I followed up and took another shot. So we're both kind of on like even ground in terms of being in Phil's favor. Yeah, yeah, exactly. But you do get to lead off. So have at it, man. Fire it away.
I'm gonna lead with a story that's not exactly uplifting, because that's kind of my beat. I take the depression shit, but it feels important. So here it goes. On March 25th, leaks were discovered in a holding pool that contained about 400 million gallons of wastewater from the Piney Point phosphate plant in Manatee County, Florida. The leak worsened over the following days, prompting fears of a containment wall collapse, which would have sent a 20-foot wall of water cascading through residential and commercial areas, and been a real bad deal. More than 300 homes were evacuated, as well as the first floor of the county jail, as emergency crews first tried to shore up the reservoir, and after that proved unsuccessful, rushed to discharge the wastewater. Crews avoided the potential catastrophe of a breached reservoir and subsequent flooding, but now nearly 300 million gallons of wastewater have been flushed into Tampa Bay. And the obvious question on my mind is, how's that going to impact the marine ecosystem and the fishery and the fish?
Of course.
So the Florida Department of Environmental Protection has repeatedly said that the wastewater meets water quality marine standards for discharge, except for elevated levels of nitrogen, phosphorus, and ammonia. And when I talked to Chris Whitman, co-founder of the Florida-based nonprofit Captains for Clean Water, he told me, quote, "That's like getting pulled over and telling the cop you were meeting the standards for legal driving, except for being drunk, speeding, and having a suspended license." So far, no evidence of fish or manatee kills have been reported, but the danger from this particular kind of pollution emerges in the long term, right? Because we talked about this before in past episodes. We've covered the impacts that elevated levels of nutrients like phosphorus and nitrogen are having on marine ecosystems, especially in Florida. They're contributing to massive algae blooms, habitat destruction, fish kills, and red tides like what happened in 2018. The Tampa Bay waterkeepers estimate that this spill dumped the equivalent of 100,000 bags of fertilizer into the bay, which is definitely not something this estuary needs. Tampa Bay has actually been a relative success story over the past few decades in terms of dealing with nutrient loading. In the 60s and 70s, much of the bay's marine habitat and seagrass were decimated by phosphate plants and sewage, but through a lot of work and a lot of money, more than 42,000 acres of seagrass has been rehabilitated, and this event threatens to undermine all that recovery. Unfortunately, we're just going to have to kind of wait and see what happens with this situation. It's not like we can't exactly predict what's going to happen, and we will follow up with you as we need to, but this incident caused me to look into something I'd never even thought about before. Before this story broke, I got to admit, I didn't know anything at all about phosphate mining. And I certainly did not know that Central Florida is the phosphate capital of the world, producing 1/4 of global supply.
Oh, I didn't know that either.
Right?
No idea. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And like, to be clear and fair, we need fertilizer. Like, fertilizer is necessary if we're going to, you know, feed the world and all the things we need to do for producing plants, all that important shit. But this industry has a problematic track record when it comes to environmental impacts in Florida. The process of phosphate mining, this is way dumbed down, but it goes something like this. You extract ore from the earth, treat it with phosphoric acid to extract the useful phosphate. You're then left with a whole lot of phosphogypsum, a radioactive waste product. And for every ton of the phosphate that you're hoping to get, you produce 5 tons of the phosphogypsum waste. You then pile that radioactive material into massive towers called gypstacks and cover them in water. The result is dozens of massive lagoons all over Florida full of radioactive water that also, you know, happen to contain high nutrient loads and heavy metals just for a little extra spice.
Sure, sprinkle it in. A little Mrs. Dash on there, yeah.
And it turns out, this is a part that wasn't very actively covered in a lot of the news. What happened at Piney Point was, it was actually kind of a best case scenario. The pond that failed is one of three ponds on that site of the defunct phosphate mine that went bankrupt in 2001. And that pond that failed is by far the least toxic of the three because it holds mostly seawater from a dredging project. If one of the other two ponds, which are full of gypstack waste, were to have failed, we'd be looking at a much more serious catastrophe.
Yeah.
And just a couple days ago, Governor DeSantis announced a cleanup plan for Piney Point that could end up costing Florida taxpayers $200 million to mitigate and put back together this mess left behind by industry. And that's just one of many similar sites all over the state. And I'm going to close this segment with a statement put out by Captains for Clean Water, because I very much respect those folks and the work they do. They're locals, Floridians, fishing guides who just now work trying to protect the resources and the fisheries around their home state. They're just good people. And they know more about this than a podcast host in Montana. So here's a quote from Chris Whitman to close it out. "We need our state legislature to introduce meaningful policy that holds polluters accountable for environmental impacts like this. The Florida legislature has systematically dismantled regulations to serve and benefit special interests. These special interests, in this case phosphate mining, are profiting off of Florida's resources at the expense of our state citizens and environment. They make their profits, exhaust the resource, and then leave the mess to taxpayers. We have to see new legislation that prevents special interests from continuing this kind of bad business that exploits our state and citizens."
I mean, I agree with all that, dude, and this is like a... It's another terrible scenario, but isn't it sad to say, like, I hear this story and I'm like, man, this is just so Florida. Like, when I think of Florida over the last couple decades, it's almost like if it's not one thing, it's another. Like, these poor guys are always just constantly fighting this battle with legislators and just blind eyes being turned to just horrible shit happening to their ecosystems down there.
And I had a long talk with Chris about this, and he made a lot of really great points that didn't make it into that story. But the thing he kept hitting on is it's not the industry's fault. Like, the industry is not breaking the law.
Right.
The legislature is not forcing them to be held accountable. They're just doing what they should. They're just doing good business.
Right.
And it is, according to him, from his perspective, the responsibility of the legislature to enact laws that put these corporations in a situation where they have to be responsible for the mess.
Yeah, it forces them to do it the right way. Yeah, exactly. So, you're right. Yeah. I get what you're saying. It's a tough spot because they're not breaking the law because the right law doesn't exist.
Right.
Essentially, and that's what's happening.
It's not that different from, you know, the big fight that Captains for Clean Water has been part of is the sugarcane industry, and he made a lot of comparisons between sugarcane and
big
phosphate
sugar.
Mining.
Yeah,
exactly.
For sure. Well, I'm certain we're going to have some follow-up on this. Maybe we even have Chris on at some point.
Love to.
This is still sort of a developing story. But since we're talking about laws and Florida, that is just could not be a better transition for me. We're going to stay in Florida, and we're going to stay talking about laws in a different way. I, on the other hand, I have good news, okay? While Florida residents, we don't know what's going to happen to Tampa Bay, you can finally sleep soundly again because after nearly a year on the lam, fugitive Daniel Armendariz has finally turned himself into authorities. And as we all know, thanks to the never-ending news coverage, Armendariz is the criminal mastermind wanted for diving into the tank at the Gulf Coast Town Center Bass Pro Shops in May 2020. I can feel the sigh of relief being breathed around the country right now.
How did I miss this story?
So, according to this story, this is from newspress.com, this incident occurred on May 10th, 2020. Armendariz has said repeatedly, this is what he says, "It just kind of happened."
Oh no.
So, that was the reasoning, as if to suggest the mood just struck him. And per the story, he swam across the huge tank's expanse, hauled himself out, and then ran dripping wet out of the store. Okay. So I really enjoyed this one, by the way. So it's just going to get better. So I think it's safe to say that the 28-year-old Armendariz thought this would just be like, haha, funny. But no, like the authorities wanted him and they weren't going to just like they weren't going to let up. Right. And he was quickly identified as the tank jumper on the Facebook page Southwest Florida Crime Stoppers and charged with trespassing. But instead of turning himself in, he just ducked the cops and blabbed on the Internet about the whole thing. So here's a post Armendariz apparently put on the Facebook group Florida Boys with a Z Hunting and Fishing. All right. Mm. Also, this post confirms this incident was not his first dust up with the law. Okay.
So, shocker.
Expletive, I'm tired of you looking for me like I'm some most wanted fugitive over a little tank dive. 10 question marks. LOL, come on now. Well, you know what, Bass Pro? I've breed fish since I was 9 years old. You can kiss my expletive about the $3,000 decontamination expletive. Yeah, I expletive diving in, but who doesn't want to dive in that beautiful tank, and who has been blasted this hard and charged with felonies? 10 question marks. Since all you authorities want to blast me like I'm some nasty criminal and offer awards, well, guess what? Get to working even more because I'll turn myself in when I'm ready. You guys have put me out to be a drug dealing, robbing, aggravated, battering criminal, but guess what? I beat all those charges. So that's wrong, expletive. Man, it is what it is. SMH, you guys are pathetic. Expletive, 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 expletive. This was printed in the news story, the whole entire passage.
That is gold right there.
Isn't that gold? Well, guess what? Armendariz was arrested nearly 2 months later on the charges of trespassing. How did they finally get this guy? Well, the sheriff's office received a call for service stating Armendariz was on his way to the Days Inn on South Cleveland Avenue threatening to shoot someone.
He was at the
motel the morning of July 1 near a vehicle containing a pump-action shotgun and more than 200 rounds of ammunition, and charged with 2 counts of resisting arrest. Now, not surprisingly, he failed to appear in court twice. In the months following his arrest, most recently in February, and pulling another ace out of his deck, he moved to North Carolina, which could not extradite him back to Florida over bench warrants. But I guess the heat was finally getting to be too much because nearly a year after ruining what already sounded like a fairly shitty existence to swim with some bass and catfish, Armendariz is back in Florida and ready to face the music. He's gotten a lawyer, likely, I'm just going to say, by way of a billboard on some Florida back road. And this is the only quote in the piece from his lawyer, right? We hear from the lawyer one time, and he just says, "We will take care of these warrants. We'll probably just go in, ... and figure it out from there." So what's the over-under that meth is somehow playing a role in this whole thing?
There's no question. It sounds very methy to me. Better Call Saul is all I can think for this dude.
Yeah, that's exactly. So I will say, I mean, look, it sounds like dude's into all kinds of bad stuff. Like he's not like a nice dude, but there's also that little baby part of me that feels for him. It's like, okay, I did a goofy thing. I jumped at a tank and like, you guys are really going to like go this hard at me for that. But like, yeah, they did.
I'd like to think that it's all the other things that are making them go hard at him. Maybe I'm wrong.
Probably. It's probably like, well, we already need to get him for these things. So like now we'll just add the tank, but he's making it sound like he's like an upstanding citizen, except for this tank jump.
Now that I'm saying this, it makes me think you don't cross Bass Pro, man. Like if there is one entity in the fishing world that you
can get away with that shit at Cabela's, but not Bass Pro.
I mean, now they're one in the same. So no. Like if you're going to cause problems with anybody in the fishing industry, that's probably not the right way to go. They have the resources to get you.
Well, yeah, they have plenty of money, and like, yeah, that is true. They're not a little mom and pop tackle shop. They have resources and a legal team. The one thing I do question though, like, do you really need to decontaminate that entire fish tank over one dude swimming in it? Like, come on. Like, that's like one of those, big money, like.
On how much meth you had in his pockets.
You beat me too. How much melted down Robitussin or whatever is now in that tank. Oh, yeah. So, yeah. Yeah.
Speaking of substances that are worth far more than they probably should be at street value, Joe, have you ever heard of ambergris?
I actually do happen to know what ambergris is. Yes.
You do. You do.
You want to take this? I don't want
to
take it. I could tell you. I could tell the people what it is.
Yeah, let's do that.
To the best of my knowledge, it's giant gobs of like petrified, solidified whale vomit that is worth shitloads of money if you know where to find it. And I know a guy. I don't know, but I know a guy. So
that's straight. That is straight up right. It is a dense, waxy substance formed by the bile ducts in the intestines of sperm whales and sperm whales only, not all whales. Just sperm whales.
Okay, so you didn't know that.
And how about this? Giant squid beaks have been found within chunks of ambergris, and the theory goes that the substance prevents sharp, undigestible objects like that from rupturing sperm whales' intestines, right? Because they eat cuttlefish and giant squid, and they can't digest the beaks. So the theory is that this substance, they evolved this substance to kind of wrap up the sharp bits so it didn't cut them up from the inside out.
Yeah.
And sperm whales probably expel ambergris like they do fecal matter, but if the mass is too large, they may vomit it up instead, hence the whale vomit thing. But biologists disagree on this point. No one's really sure how it comes out or even if it comes out. Fresh ambergris is described as having a marine fecal odor, but as it floats around...
What is marine fecal?
But as it floats around in the ocean and ages, it takes on a sweet, earthy, musky scent, which is often compared to rubbing alcohol without the chemical astringency.
None of these smell good. What is marine fecal? Like, I know what dead, rotten fish smells like, and I know what dog shit smells like. I don't know what, like, marine shit smells like. Who says that? Okay.
Several sources. Chunks of ambergris can float around for years before eventually washing up on shore, which is where people usually find it. Mm-hmm. According to London's Natural History Museum, humans have used and valued rare ambergris for at least 1,000 years, though its origin remained unknown until large-scale whaling began in the 1800s. It's sometimes called floating gold or treasure of the sea, or its other common name, as you pointed out, is whale vomit, which is somewhat less appealing.
Straightforward, yeah.
Early civilizations used ambergris for all kinds of applications, but it was highly prized as an aphrodisiac. And throughout the past few centuries, it's remained valuable because it contains ambrine, I think that's how I'm supposed to pronounce that, which is added to perfume to make the scent last longer. In the last few decades, chemists have come up with much cheaper synthetic alternatives, but super high-end perfumes still use naturally occurring ambergris. So it remains incredibly valuable. High-quality ambergris can sell for $10,000 a pound, and an 8-pound piece is considered a big find.
Huh.
But last February, a group of Yemeni fishermen lucked into a serious chunk of this stuff. I got to preface this by saying, life as a commercial fisherman in Yemen has never been like what we would consider cush, comfortable. Yeah. Or easy.
They don't have a PS5. Yeah.
No. These guys take really small vessels out in the Gulf of Aden, which is this water that connects the Red Sea and the Arabian Sea. And on like a particularly great outing, like if everything goes right, they're out for a few days and they come back to market with a full boat and everything goes perfectly, a Yemeni fisherman might earn the equivalent of $50 each time, like when they really score. Yeah.
Right. Right.
But since civil war broke out in 2014, that already hard life has become like nearly impossible. 2/3 of the 30 million residents are relying on humanitarian aid right now. And it's really tough for fishermen because many parts of the Yemeni coast are war zones. So fishing is prohibited in certain places and even unrestricted areas can just erupt in conflict. Like it's a bad deal. So the fishermen who found this ambergris in the story are from the village of Al-Kaisa, I believe. An area in the southern Aden province. And that zone, like this is important context, that zone they're in has less fighting and fewer restrictions. And on the day that they struck whale gold, They just happened to have this other guy on board with them who's from a village further north. And this guy had fled the war to a more a safer part to earn a living. He was also a fisherman, but he's like, I can't fish my homeland, so I got to come south. He hopped on these guys' boats. They went out. And they're on their way to the fishing grounds, and they pass a large dead sperm whale that had been floating around in the area for some time. One of the local fishermen told the Mideast Eye, quote, "We had passed by that same dead fish more than once, and we didn't give it any attention, as the sea is full of dead fish." But on this particular trip, they had that dude from the northern village with them, and he recognized that that was a sperm whale. And he knew about the ambergris.
Yeah.
So he told him, like, hold on, guys. Forget about the fishing. We got to take in this whale. And I can imagine the conversation that went on when they're like, you want us to do what? He's like, no. Well, we got to take in this whale carcass.
Are you getting to the legality of this? Because, like, can you do that? I mean, over here, totally the U.S. legal. Water is like, you cannot mess with a dead marine mammal.
It's Yemen, dude.
Well, okay.
They're not concerned about that. Like they got bigger that problems. Was
like a global law. I don't know.
No, I'm not. There, it is actually legal what they did. I dug into that. It's legit. They're not okay. Breaking any laws. So they had to get a bunch of other boats to drag this thing in. And again, this is guys that outsiders convincing all these fishermen, like, hey, stop doing what you're doing that you know is going to make you money. Trust me, we got to drag this whale carcass in. It's going to be great. And then. Ultimately, they got the whole village involved. Over 100 fishermen helped drag and dismember this just like disgustingly rotten beast up on the beach, which, again, you're putting a lot on these guys. Be like, hey, now start hacking this thing up.
Yeah. How did this dude, like, isn't it also a gamble? Like, did he know? Like, how do you know? It's like getting an oyster. Yeah. You could eat 10 million oysters and not find a pearl. Like, you don't
Only
know.
Only 5% right? of whale carcasses have this in them. And usually it's just a small amount. So
wow.
He had to be a very compelling dude. And it worked out because they found a chunk of ambergris in that whale that weighed 280 pounds.
Oh, my God.
And so then they all had to, like, rally together and take turns guarding that foul-smelling awfulness until they were able to, like, find someone to sell it to. And they sold it to a broker from the United Arab Emirates for the equivalent of $1.5 million, which they then distributed throughout the community. So, like, most families got $12,000, which is enough for a young fisherman to marry and build a house or to purchase his own boat, which is, like, a total game changer for these folks.
That's cool. That's cool.
And they distributed, like, the whole – it was a village of 1,000 families. They distributed it out. Everybody got what they needed. They bought medicines for folks. Like, it was a really great story of not just – hey, we found this thing and we pirated it and a couple people got rich. Like, they really used it to distribute funds throughout the community, and this whole fishing village is now better off for it. And it's a rare bit of good news coming out of part of the world that doesn't have a lot of good news these days.
Yeah.
And it came in the form of whale vomit.
I gotta say, man, like, I feel like this is prompting me to do more research because there's so much more I want to know. Like, how often does this wash up? Where does it wash up most often? Like, can I find this 4th of July weekend at, like, my in-law's beach house? Like,
the most common place to find it is the Bahamas.
And I also wonder, Ambergris K in yep. Belize, is that yep. named because, like, it used to wash up there more or something?
Or at least it washed up there once.
Yeah. But yeah. Then my next question would be, if I do on 4th of July weekend, like, stumble on this, right? Like, who the hell do you call? Like, oh, now I got to unload 200 pounds of ambergris. Like, what do you call, the fish market? Like, who do you call?
I got nothing on that one, man.
That shit on Facebook, you know what I mean? Facebook marketplace.
If that comes up, it's definitely going to be a sale bin. I'm just saying right now.
Yeah, 100%. But, dude, no, I think that's really fascinating. I also had no idea that anybody was still using that in cosmetics and perfume. Like, that's got to be some super high-end stuff. Because if you think about it, it's sustainable. Yeah. You don't actually have to – I knew historically we used whale blubber for cosmetics mm-hmm. and oil lamps, and that's why we killed, like, almost every whale. But the whale doesn't have to die to get this stuff, so – yeah, man, I could see, especially in like the boutique world we live in, there's got to be some perfume makers, whatever they're called, that are just like, man.
All about it.
You must smell real good. So we'll move on from.
So marine fecal matter-ish.
Yeah. You she smelled of marine fecal. Yeah, it's a great selling point there. Yep. I'm gonna stay on dead fish here. Not a big one, but a lot of them. And this is a short story that's just gonna, I think, lead to some conversation here. It also lets me stay in crime. I'm doing the crime thing today. I'm like the CSI to Catch a Predator, America's Most Wanted for Anglers today. So we already got the sumbitch that had the audacity to jump in the Bass Pro tank. Let's move on to Catch a Criminal. Anyway, this is a short but poignant story, and this comes from Arizona's azfamily.com. Headline, police make arrest after 1,000 pounds of fish were dumped in Phoenix. And it's such a short story, I'm just gonna burn through it. Police have arrested a suspect in connection to 1,000 pounds of fish that were found dumped along a Phoenix road on Tuesday. Police Sergeant Ann Justice said detectives were able to develop probable cause to arrest 42-year-old Russell Omar Howard Thursday. It started when police were called to the area of 15th Avenue and Pinnacle Peak Road for reports of illegal dumping. When officers arrived, they found a large pile of trash, including several dead fish. Arizona Game and Fish confirmed to Arizona Family that at least 1,000 pounds of carp and gizzard shad, boxes and trash from a spearfishing tournament at Lake Pleasant over the weekend were dumped in the area of 15th Avenue and Pinnacle Peak Road. And this dude now faces one count of criminal littering, which is a class 6 felony. So I did a little research in the Lake Pleasant spearfishing, didn't know anything about it. And this is a big deal there. Like it's a fairly big tourist destination. It's very clear, at least from the videos I've seen, and it seems a lot of people go there to spearfish for stripers, serious dudes. And I was trying to find information on this specific tournament to see if it was judged by total weight or what. I didn't really find much, but regardless, this is very similar, in my opinion, to the Sebago Lake trout story we covered.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, in that this act, like this shit, gives an entire faction of anglers a bad name. And in the case of Sebago, it was ice fishermen looking kind of like pigs, basically, for leaving all these dead fish on the ice. And I think this, like what happened here in Phoenix, this is something that not only tarnishes the spearfishing community, but bow fishermen for sure. And for the record, I don't know if I've ever said this on this show, but I really enjoy bow fishing. And it's not something that I do often, but I find it extremely fun. And I can also say that I've never been in a position where I had to figure out what to do with the 45 carp I shot because I can't shoot worth a shit. Like I just am
aim
terrible.
I'm really low.
And as I'm doing it, I'm like aim low and then aim. I know all the things. This somehow at the last second it just doesn't touch the fish. So this is not a personal issue that I have. But you know what happens to piles of common carp, whether they were shot with a spear or arrow, is one of those things that I think people in general sort of turn a blind eye to. It's like everyone knows the vast majority of the time those fish are probably going to be wasted. Like not many people are finding plates for 100 pounds of fried common carp meat.
Yeah.
But what keeps people from going overly ballistic about the sport is simply not seeing it. You know, and you know, one of the guys I used to shoot with, he swore that he had people eager to take his fish to eat. And again, up here on the river, you're not having 100 fish night like you would in Texas or where, you know, it's just not, you don't shoot that many fish. And another buddy of mine, he said he had the best racket going because he'd trade the carp with the commercial lobster guys for lobsters because apparently carp make like exceptional trap bait. But
I would do that all day.
Exactly. The lobster guys say that, man, common carp is terrific lobster bait for their traps. But I mean, look, I never saw any of that with my own eyes. I trusted that was the case because these were buddies of mine. And that made me sleep a little easier after my one or two bow trips a season. And I don't want to make it sound like I was overly upset about taking a few carp out of the river. But I mean, you know, I'm a rod and reel guy first that mostly catches and releases, which is why I would never bowfish like twice a week all summer. Like it's too much. Like a trip here and there every once in a while, I can get behind that. But you know, those fish could have ended up in a dumpster, which while that might upset some people too, it's far better than dumping the fish on the side of the road because less chance for people to see it. And it's dumb moves like this that ruin shit for the responsible guys, or at least I should say the guys with enough sense to recognize that if you're going to waste a bunch of carp and shad, like you waste them away from prying eyes. And I hate to say it, I hope the dude gets hit with the charges. Like that's a shit move.
Yeah. Yeah, the dumping is a really, there's no question. That's not even a gray area. That's just terrible.
Yeah.
But the issue of what to do with rough fish that mm-hmm. you bowfish, and I gotta step back. Common carp, I get. Gizzard shad, are those non-native? Are those invasive? Are those an issue in the body of water that we're talking about here?
That I don't know. I would think not. I mean, man, gizzard shad are kind of everywhere.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, I can see I get the justification, common carp, invasive fish, problematic. I struggle with the wanton waste of native fish species and rough fish.
Yep.
It's something that I don't have a problem with bow fishing at all. And I also enjoy it, but I don't do it very often, partially because I'm like, man, if I shoot a couple carp, the hell, I mean, you put one in the garden or whatever, like a buddy's garden.
Exactly.
Because as we've already talked about on the show, I've never successfully done that. But what do you do after that? Like, I don't necessarily want to eat them, and I don't want to have to figure out what to do with them. I recognize that is it legal to throw them away in a dumpster? I don't actually know the answer to that question.
I don't know it either. I mean, that's probably a state by state thing. I truly don't know. But what I can tell you about the gizzard shad, at least from some of my experience here, it's like, I know a lot of bow fishermen that it's like, can I shoot that? Can I legally shoot that? Yes. Then I'll fire at it. You know what I'm saying? And like gizzard shad, it's like, oh, that is okay for me to shoot at, so I will shoot at it. Like, I never really shot at a ton of gizzard shad. Like, that's not what I was out there for. Like, you're trying to whack a couple carp, and it is what it is. But the question of why would you do that? Because you can. Because I just know there are bow guys who are like that. Like, everything that comes into the light, it's like, can I shoot that? Well, yeah. Boom. Like, and it's hit.
You know, and this is, and I know I hit this all the time, but this is where it brings me back to the big mouth buffalo thing, which we all know. Absolutely. I'm fully obsessed with big mouth buffalo. I admit it. And I'm not excited about them being such a popular target for bow fishers because I want them to be around for other reasons, because they're part of the ecosystem and because I want to catch them in other ways. I get harvesting a few of them because I know they're delicious and great. If that's what you're doing, do it. It's legal. But I struggle with the going out and just killing a bunch of fish to kill a bunch of fish, particularly if they're native fish like suckers that are part of the ecosystem. Like that doesn't sit well with me. I can't condone that.
Well, this is totally op-ed. We're certainly not coming to a conclusion on this, but just to point out that, I mean, that dude's kind of a jerk for dumping all those fish there. And no matter where you stand on bow fishing, I mean, you can't. That is exactly the kind of thing that gets hackles up in the sport.
It makes us look bad.
I'm sure. It makes us look bad. So I'm sure, you know, hey, you know how to find us, ben@themeateater.com. Weigh in. Let us know what you think. We're going to let we're going to see what Phil thinks of us and our stories this week. And then as soon as we're done doing that, believe it or not, I am getting us back on the striper scene with the freaking Philistines.
Oh.
I read a book. Joe read a book. So stay tuned for that.
It was educational. It was informative. It was entertaining. Miles, let's shower you in some ambergris. You're the winner this week. By referencing both the Konami Code and Fallout Boy, yes, Joe, I got that reference, it seems like you guys are trying to both pander to and mock me at the same time. Feel like Carrie. If you guys end up crowning me prom queen next week, I swear to God, I will not even wait for that pig's blood. I will f*** you up.
What's a Philistine?
It's a guy who doesn't care about books or interesting films and things.
Then I'm a Philistine.
When David DiBenedetto's On the Run hit bookstore shelves in the early 2000s, my soul was crushed. And at the time, I was in college, often fighting to stay awake in class because I'd been surf fishing all night or skipping it entirely to catch the right tide on some North Jersey jetty. I was also scheming about how I'd get my break in the outdoor journalism game, and one night it hit me. How cool would it be to follow the entire striped bass migration up and down the East Coast and document it? It had never been done before. That is, until DiBenedetto did it and wrote an entire book about it. I got over it pretty quickly, though, and I even wrote DiBenedetto an email telling him how jealous I was, but also how much I loved the book. Because in my opinion, despite there being several other great books about the striper scene out there, none came close to capturing the entirety of it so beautifully. Growing up in the 90s, striped bass were almost non-existent. To me, they were mythic, unattainable. And their rebound coincided with that point in my life when you're just old enough to do whatever the hell you want, and also when you had very little responsibility. And I was already in love with chasing stripers, but On the Run made me feel like I was part of something so much bigger. On the Run kicks off in Maine on Labor Day weekend 2001, just prior to the attacks on September 11th. And it ends in late November on the Outer Banks of North Carolina. But what happens in between has less to do with fish and much more to do with people. DeBenedetto spent time with all the most notable characters in every faction of the striper scene, and plenty of less notable people fighting to preserve these fish or fighting to make a living catching them. Every new person he encounters presents a new perspective and new adventure. DeBenedetto famously opens the book terrified as he skishes with Paul Melnick, a Montauk local that swims out and drifts hundreds of yards offshore while dangling live eels. He gets to witness legendary surfcaster Tony Stetsko almost come to blows with another angler on the beach that crowded him. And he sits down with former world record holder Al McReynolds and learns that catching such a coveted fish may have been more curse than blessing. And in one of my favorite scenes, he rubs elbows in a Rhode Island bar with a group of guys I idolized as a teen surfcaster. He's brought to this bar after diving with well-known spear fisherman and underwater videographer Mike Laptu. Here's a taste. When we arrived, Laptu spotted a few trucks in the parking lot with fishing rods locked on their roofs. "Looks like the gang's here," he said. Inside, where the yuppie decor seemed more suitable to a gathering of sailing skippers, Laptu told the hostess, "We're with a group that smells like fish." At the table, everyone went by their handles from the site Stripers Online. The group consisted of Crafty Angler, Tattoo, DZ, and Hab. There was also a fellow, Iron Mike, who didn't belong to Stripers Online. According to Laptu, these guys were among Rhode Island's most hardcore striper fishermen. Haberek, who was built like a linebacker and sported a thick handlebar mustache, was the center of attention. When I sat down, he pulled out a lure box full of varying-sized needlefish, long plugs that range in size from the width of a broomstick to that of a pencil. Iron Mike and Tattoo started rubbing their hands together. Most sharpies feel Haberek's needlefish have no equal when it comes to seducing big bass. When stocks run low at tackle shops, anglers will often call Haberek pleading for a personal shipment. "You won't believe the things guys will do for these plugs. I had to stop giving out my number," he told me. When Haberek opened the box, Tattoo snatched up a chartreuse needlefish and ran it under his nose like a fine cigar. "Oh, this is real nice," he said. Cries of "plug ho" went up around the table. Plug ho is a term of derision for any member of SOL who displays loose morals in the quest for a hard-to-come-by plug. Everyone at the table was jazzed for the fall run. It was proving to be the best in recent memory. The bait had stayed close to shore for the past few weeks, and day-long blitzes were common. When I told the guys that the fishermen on the islands in Vineyard Sound were having a meek year, there was little sympathy. Iron Mike, a spark plug of a fellow who got louder with each beer and seemed to somehow work into every sentence, had landed a 51-pounder on a Habs needlefish just a few days prior. "It can be boom or bust in the fall, and we're booming this year," he said. I asked the group about the sharing of information on the internet. Many fishermen I had met on my trip abhorred the idea of posting secret strategies and drops on fishing websites. This gang was no different. General information was fine, but posting a report with the exact location of where you whacked the fish was a deadly sin. We all had to pay our dues. Why should some lurker who doesn't know squat have the privilege of being told where to go and what to use? The learning process is part of the sport, said Tattoo. Some members had even devised a code for exchanging information. The following day, Tattoo sent me an example. It read, "The pattern is open. You're cleared for Twinkies. It was 20 times before puke. Pink was the color of the sky in 1977. 7 times I like pink. I like to swim metal. 12 was a good year. Pukers like steel 6 times." DeBenedetto didn't have a crystal ball, but he unknowingly captured what I'd consider the last years of true purity in the striper scene. Message boards were a thing, but this was long before Facebook and Instagram. You still had to put in your time, maybe lean on a mentor, get in with the right crowd. You needed more than a photo to be considered the man or to earn a reputation as a sharpie. Everybody and their uncle wasn't a custom lure maker. John Haberek made lures that caught fish, not fishermen, and would probably be pissed off about how much people will spend on one of his plugs these days as a collector's item. Now, Hab is sadly gone. So is Tony Stetsko. And so is Al McReynolds. But saddest of all is that the run DiBenedetto followed is gone too. Nobody catches stripers in the Outer Banks anymore. Striper numbers are on the decline, and the textbook route they once followed has been altered by everything from beach replenishment to overfishing to global warming and beyond. But I owe this book for a lot more than solidifying my love of striper fishing, because not long after it was published, DiBenedetto became the editor-in-chief of Saltwater Sportsman, which had recently moved to New York City, and through a few lucky connections, I got to interview for an internship. And when I met Dave, he said, "Aren't you the guy that emailed me about my book?" And he gave me my first full-time magazine job ever in 2005. And here I am now, still on my own run in the craziness that is the fishing industry.
All right. First off, everyone, Joe tackled a Philistine segment. Phil, can we get a round of applause for Joe on that one, please? Thank you.
I am hooked on fish and on phonics this week. So
it turns out you don't just write books. You know how to read them, too. I'm so proud. I do.
Thank you.
Also, you managed to hit a classic book that I've never read, though it's been recommended to me more than once. And so I need to get on that. It sounds like it actually does a very, very good job of capturing the entirety of the fishing culture that we're talking about. And that's not easy to do. I personally very much enjoyed the Pete McDonald and Tosh Brown book, The Blitz, which profiled the scene in a similar way at a different time period and in a more visual format. But I think I'm going to enjoy that longer form narrative even better.
Yeah, you will. You would love this book. And the first time I read that book, it had a pretty profound impact on me. And little did I know that within just a couple years, I'd be working for Dave DiBenedetto at Saltwater Sportsman and
That's
would
amazing.
End up meeting, or corresponding with so many people in that book. So in a way, it's like a part of my surf fishing roots.
This whole episode is like a little window into Joe's origin story.
Right. It is.
And as well as being a peek into one of the biggest and most engaged fishing subcultures in the country. It's just, it's huge, right? If you look at the numbers, striper fishing is massive.
Yes,
but it's
it is.
So localized.
Yep.
Right? And so a lot of us, myself included, even hardcore anglers, have no personal frame of reference with this, but we're aware of it. And at least for me, like even though I don't have that direct experience, I get it. Like I understand what's going on because it's still fishing. Right. Because at one point when you and Bill Wetzel were talking, and I was just sort of sitting there listening, being like, "Oh, this is amazing." We had to stop the interview, just like mid-interview, just cut it off so you two could geek out over who had the rarest custom wooden striper plugs.
Yeah, we literally both got up for a second. We're like, "Oh yeah," and like got up to grab some ammo to have a plugs showdown over Zoom. Right? He threw down first, though. He's like, "Look what I got." I'm like, "Oh yeah, yeah." As he would say, "Oh yeah, mother." So I presented a metal-lipped surface swimmer made by Twisted, which I could go on and on about it, but just suffice it to say, I've been offered a lot of money for it because it's a rare one.
None of you guys were going deep, and none of the specifics of any of those baits or the bait makers or the particular like paint jobs, none of that made any sense to me. Like it meant nothing to me. I got what was going on. I understood like, oh, this is a pecking order thing. Who's got the weirdest, coolest bait? but I definitely, even though I didn't know those exact names or why they were special, I very much recognized the style of the lures, right? The individual exact lures themselves, no idea. But I can see the style. Like I see the DNA of where those came from. And that's where we're going to as we close out the show, because in this week's End of Line segment, we're going to talk about how so many lures considered classics in the striper scene actually have Midwest ingenuity to thank for their design.
Fishy, 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 fishy!
Well, that's not loud enough, Bert.
The Creek Chub Pikey Minnow might be the most iconic vintage lure ever produced. With its scooped-out nose, uniquely tapered tail, and, of course, patented step-down metal lip, the Pikey Minnow pops into most of our heads when we imagine old fishing lures. Before Rapala came to dominate the plug scene, there was Creek Chub. Though the Pikey was Creekchub's biggest selling lure and most recognizable design, it wasn't the first. The Wiggler, designed way back in 1906 by three fishing buddies from Garrett, Indiana, was the first lure to incorporate a diving lip, or a mouthpiece, as they originally called it. This was the first time in recorded history that an inanimate object personified the wiggle of a frightened baitfish, a minor miracle of spontaneous generation modern anglers hardly even noticed. From 1916 to the mid-1960s, Creekchub and the Pikey Minnow dominated freshwater fish and fishing and set a standard for lure quality never again seen in production lures. The company only used white cedar wood for the bodies. Each lure was hand-painted with at least 7 and sometimes up to 14 coats of paint. They devised a proprietary netting through which they could apply that paint to create a realistic scale pattern on each bait. The steel treble hooks were imported from Norway. That insistence on quality ultimately became their undoing, because once plastic hit the market, Creekchub simply couldn't compete. And in 1978, the company went out of business. Entire books have been written about the history of this company and this lure, so I'm not going to belabor all the specifics, but I think contemporary anglers forget how groundbreaking this lure was. Because of their popularity, Creekchub naturally found their baits attached to some of the most controversial big fish dust-ups of all time. First, the holy grail of American fishing records, George Perry's 22-pound, 4-ounce largemouth that stood as the all-tackle bass record for almost 90 years, was caught on a Creekchub. Only no one's totally sure which Creekchub, since Perry's story changed throughout his life. It wasn't a Pikey Minnow, we don't think, but no one's totally sure. The Pikey Minnow is at the center of a different and only slightly less heated record fish controversy, the world record muskie. The standing record weighed 69 pounds, 11 ounces, and was caught in 1949 by Louis Spray from the Chippewa Flowage in Wisconsin. But from 1969 to 1992, the record was actually held by Art Lawton, who claims to have caught a muskie 4 ounces heavier from the St. Lawrence River in New York on a Pikey Minnow. In 1992, the IGFA declared Lawton's record fraudulent, stating that modern scrutiny of available evidence showed it to be smaller than its certified weight and length. I would love to digress into the churning operatic drama that surrounds these two musky record chasers and their fish, which includes no shortage of outlaw buffoonery and alcohol-fueled transgressions on basic decency, but we're not here to talk about the musky record. We're talking about the Pikey Minnow, and regardless of any BS around particular records and fragile egos, this bait may have caught more big freshwater fish than any other. By the time Rapala even crossed the pond, Pikey Minnows were allegedly responsible for a 20-pound largemouth in 1924, a 36-pound pike in 1927, an 18-pound walleye in 1933, an 11-pound smallmouth in 1941, and another 11-pound spotted bass in 1944. That's plenty enough to solidify its place in fishing history.
That was very good, but I'm going to step in now and add a pinch of salt to your pikey history, because this is our striper show, and there's more to this story. So while everything that you just said is accurate, and the pikey has certainly solidified its place in freshwater fishing history, prior to World War II, the striper surf casting scene as we know it now didn't really exist. And if you wanted to catch them, you soaked bait. In fact, lobster tail was a common offering because lobsters were actually considered something only poor people ate back in the day. Now, there were also some metal lures and tin lures being slung around, but when the boys came home from war, surf casting, like many other scenes, boomed. Those surf casters figured out quickly that those musky and pike-sized pikey minnows were equally appealing to striped bass, and because, as you noted, they were made so well, they could also stand up to them. There was so much demand for pikeys on the coast that in 1950, Creekchub introduced the striper pikey, an even heavier-duty version of the original. Then in 1953, Creekchub dropped the Surfster. It had the stepped lip, similar to the pikey, but a fatter, rounder, more tapered body than a pikey, which was kind of more cigar-shaped. It was the Surfster that would become the template for many similar plugs, including those Bill Wetzel and I were geeking out about on that Zoom call of ours. Metal-lipped swimmers is the category of lure we're talking about, because they fly far in the surf. They're built to take a beating. They wobble and roll across the surface and create a really distinct V-wake. While creek chub may have had a big chunk of the market for a time, like you said, by the late 60s, the Surfster and many of their other lines had been discontinued and nobody was really throwing pikies in the surf at all anymore. Aside from plastic lures dominating the market by then, other brands of metal lip swimmer, notably Stan Gibbs' Danny Swimmer, had sort of taken hold, partly, at least I think, because they were made in Massachusetts and striper fishermen were then and are now fiercely loyal to local plug makers. Today, there are hundreds of small shop regional builders that turn metal lip swimmers, all of which share design elements with the pikey and the Surfster. And while I know plenty of striper guys that proudly display vintage pikeys on shelves, I don't know anybody that chucks them. So you mentioned that Creek Chub went out of business in 1978, which is true, but the name was purchased by Pradco Lures shortly thereafter, and Creek Chub does still exist today, though everything now is made out of plastic. Matter of fact, in the early 2000s, in what I assume was an attempt to capture the growing surf market as striper populations rebounded, Pradco did a saltwater pikey reissue, pumping out all the biggest sizes made of molded plastic and featuring trusted modern striper colors like yellow school bus and blurple. And I remember getting a few samples and being super pumped about them, but to be honest, I don't think I ever threw them. Because when it came down to maximizing time on the beach, standing there in the surf, I trusted the beat-up Gibbs and RM Smiths and Lefty Swimmers already in my surf bag. And I think most striper guys felt the same way, and as fast as the reissued pikeys appeared, they were gone from tackle shop shelves. So that's it for this week, and we hope you enjoyed our little foray into the striper scene, and I wouldn't be surprised if we pick another scene down the road and go all in again, because this was fun.
Yeah, yeah, we definitely will. I'm calling dibs on tilapia. Because we all know how much I love tilapia.
You got it. Yeah.
I feel like we're missing something though. I feel like there's a very smoky elephant in the room that we need to talk about. How did our resident striper surf expert Bob the Garbage Man not show up in this episode? Like, how did you not bring him in?
This is a terrific question. I'll tell you what happened. I sent him an outline of the show topics and he looked it over and was like, I'm not interested. As soon as he saw the things we were going to be talking about. But he did leave this message for me.
Yeah, tell Niles he'll catch more stripers on them creek chubs in Aspen or wherever the f*** he lives than anywhere out here. And you'd learn more about stripers from Curious George Goes Fishing than that Directory of Notable Mooks book you was talking about or whatever.
Well, there you go. Pretty sure I just lost whatever street cred I may have once had with Bob. Hopefully we haven't lost any with all of you out there listening, but if we have, let us know. Just send an email to bent@themeateater.com. It's also the perfect place to send us bar nominations, sale bin items, awkward photos, news leads, and all that other good stuff we're looking forward to.
Yes. And finally, catch up on B-Side Fishing on YouTube, yes. Damn it. And tune in to B-Side next week to watch me hunt down the lowliest, most unappreciated member of the Esox family. Those who know me know exactly what that is. We've also always got eyes on those Degenerate Angler and Bent podcast hashtags. And if anyone now has eyes on my rare Twisted Swimmer with the Mahi Mahi paint job, of which like one or two were ever made, back off because that shit's not for sale.